More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Buck Sexton Show. I have Tudor Dixon with me now. Not only does she have the coolest name that I have heard in a long time, and my name is Buck Sexton, so I feel like I know something about at least unusual names. Her name is just straight up cool. She ran for governor of Michigan, came really close to defeating the Wicked Witch of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, which would have been amazing. Is a mom, is an American patriot, wife, commentator, soon to be podcaster, Michigander. Tudor Dixon, great to have you on.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So how do you decide? I always like to start with the origin story. You know, it's almost like a comic book. How do you decide to get into this game? I mean, you know, I was rooting for you so much because I was a New Yorker during the pandemic, and Michigan was one of the only places where I didn't expect the lockdowns to get as crazy as it got, if that makes sense. New York, LA, DC, sure. Michigan? Is that what happened?
Right. Yes. So we were watching this happen, and the origin story kind of goes back far because my origin story in Michigan starts in a steel foundry. So I spent most of my career in the steel foundry on the shop floor, working the product through, helping make sure we get it on time to our customers. And then in 2017, I had a friend come to me and say, I don't know if you know what's happening in our schools, but it's really kind of this anti-American message. And I want to provide a news service for middle and high school students that would be pro-America, but also talk about jobs. And that was near and dear to my heart because it was really hard for us to find people to come and work in the shop. And I thought, this is great. This is an opportunity to introduce young people to manufacturing. And I think that's lost on a lot of young people these days. But then as we expanded that, we grew into conservative media, into the political world. And then 2020 came and I saw factories shut down. I saw people out of work. I saw our communities really falling apart. And I saw my own kids at home. They're not at school. My 10-year-old at one point looked at me and she goes, Mom, I was putting her to bed and she started crying. And I said, why are you crying, honey? And I think as adults, we started to forget that our kids were home for so long without ever leaving the house. They weren't even allowed to go to the grocery store with us. And she looked at me and she said, I think this is what it feels like to be depressed. And that was sort of that crowning blow where I said, we've got to do something. And talked to some friends and we thought, who's going to run? Who is going to run for governor in Michigan? And we talked to folks in Lansing. There wasn't that traditional politician type person stepping up to do it. And I had this crazy moment where I was like, how truly hard can it be to run for governor? And it turns out it's kind of hard.
Tell me, I want to get back to the running for governor thing in a second. I'm just curious about that. Again, as somebody who wasn't in politics, you just decided to run for governor in a serious state. You know, it's not like the governor of Rhode Island, let's be honest. You know what I mean? I mean, you know, no offense to Rhode Island, but come on. But you know, you know, I'm just saying, Michigan's got a lot of people. So the steel foundry, when someone sees you, I don't think they're thinking, this is somebody who was on the floor of the steel foundry. What is that like? How is the American steel industry doing? I'm always curious about that. I wonder, you know, we were the best in the world. Are we still the best in the world? And tell me about steel.
Well, I think this is really interesting because the steel industry, well, I come from the foundry industry. So what we're doing is we're pouring molten metal into a sand mold and making a product for someone like a Caterpillar or a John Deere. So we did a lot of mining, military, heavy equipment, farm equipment, things like that. But you're making pieces for someone else. And this was something that over the Obama years, we really saw a lot going to China. And China was really taking over that space. And they really have. There's not that many steel foundries left in the United States. And it's such a crucial part of what we do because, as I said, it's in all of your farm equipment. I mean, this is what your vehicles are made out of. This is what your military vehicles are made out of. We made quite a few parts for the MRAP vehicles at that time. And you just think about the idea of these things coming over from China. Now, a lot of our military equipment has a 90% or 80% Buy America clause, but you still have a portion of that that can come from another country. And so I know you hear people on our side of the aisle talking about America First quite a bit. So I think America First is something that we have to break into a few different categories. When we look at America First, because coming from the steel industry, I knew what it was like. I watched our patterns, our parts go overseas bit by bit by bit until our foundry closed and many other foundries closed. So I think when we think about America First, we really need to think about how much do we feel comfortable having in China? And then how much of that do we need to bring back to the United States? But some
can
people
I, can
don't
I ask
understand.
That question real quick, Tudor? How do we bring it back? Is it just because the labor in China is obviously a lot cheaper? Do we have advantages either technologically or just do we just make a better product here? How do we bring it back here? Is it tariffs? How
well,
do we do
what it? That's what I was going to say. A lot of people don't understand that it's some of these parts, once you close the factories, these factories don't start up again. And there aren't a lot of people out there that are saying, what should I do? Why don't I start up a steel foundry? They're very hard to start up. So, and it's very hard to operate. There's not a whole lot of knowledge of how to do it yet left in the United States. So certain trades are really being lost completely to the United States. So in that case, I would say, well, how do we find a friendly country to make sure we're outsourcing to a friendly country? And then if we can over time bring that back, I would love to see those jobs come back. But I want to be realistic too and say there are certain technologies that we do really well. And there are certain technologies that are a lost art in the United States that we need to find an allied country rather than an adversarial country to do business in. And I know that's an unpopular view, but I'm coming from a place of really having seen it, been on the shop floor. And I know we have great steel foundries here. As much business as we can put on them, we should. But in the cases where you just can't find a source, you need to go to an allied country. That's so important that we start talking about that relationship with our allies and making sure that's secure. If you think the United States sent $150 billion worth of product to China last year. China sent $560 billion worth of product to the United States. So although they are very reliant on us to be their biggest buyer, we are also very reliant on them for our pharmaceuticals, for our steel, for almost every product. There's a piece of it in China when you think about $560 billion worth of imports. I was just talking to General Mattis over the weekend and I said, so don't you think that seems like, well, China doesn't really want to attack us if we are their biggest customer? And he said, but you're thinking from a logical standpoint. You're thinking from a logical point of view. And that's not necessarily how you have to think when you're talking about countries like that, which I think is something we have to remember. And that's something that goes beyond government. That goes to the private sector, because you know, and I know, that the majority of these companies are private sector. This isn't our military equipment. This isn't all government. This is private sector. So when you think about not having pharmaceuticals, we really need to be pushing those companies to use friendly countries or come back to the United States.
I want to ask you about running for governor in a second, but a word from our sponsor here, Tunnel to Towers Foundation. Born from the tragedy of 9/11, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation has been honoring America's heroes and their families ever since. The foundation honors fallen and severely injured heroes and their families with mortgage-free smart homes. This year alone, hundreds of Gold Star and fallen first responder families with young children and our nation's most severely injured veterans and first responders are receiving smart homes. More than 500 homeless veterans received housing last year alone. More than 1,500 are receiving housing services this year. And this coming Memorial Day, all of the brave men and women lost since 9/11 in the War on Terror are having their names read aloud in a Tunnel to Towers ceremony in our nation's capital. Through the Tunnel to Towers 9/11 Institute, the foundation is educating kids in kindergarten through 12th grade about our nation's darkest day. Join Tunnel to Towers on its mission to do good. Please help America to never forget its greatest heroes. Join me in donating $11 a month to Tunnel to Towers at t2t.org. That's T, the number 2t.org. I donate every month to Tunnel to Towers. I hope you can all watching at home or listening donate as well if you can. So, Tudor, running for governor. You're hanging out with some friends. You're in Michigan. You're like, no one else is running. Gretchen Whitmer is horrible, like truly horrible. I don't really care. I'm going to say this. You know, I'm in Florida now. I was in New York for almost 40 years of my life, give or take the college years and some CIA years thrown in there. But I don't really care about other states' governors very much, right? Like if someone asked me, what do I think of the governor of Wyoming? I don't even know who the governor of Wyoming is off the top of my head. I'm not going to lie. Your governor, though, was like Fauci in a wig. Like your governor was the absolute worst. So you step up to stop the madness. What's that process like? I mean, what'd you learn from doing it? And would you do it again?
Well, I've said to people, maybe it's like pregnancy and you forget and then you do it again. Like maybe there's that chance, because it really is very, very hard. It's interesting because I think what people don't understand, and this is one of the questions we got over and over again, it was like, why don't you come out and say these things are lies, or why are they allowed to lie about you? When you're a public figure, you know this, Buck, they can say things about you and there's no defamation clause. You can't go after them. So they can make up anything they want. And I think that was the hardest part, was seeing them make things up about my family, seeing them splice up my words and create commercials out of things that I didn't really say to make it look like I said something that I hadn't said. That was really challenging. But also, I mean, the whole process is incredibly brutal, because you go through this battle with your own side first. You're fighting your own side first, and it gets really ugly. And people that you have trusted for years do things and turn against you, and you think, wow, this is really harsh. I mean, you remember Donald Trump. A lot of times Donald Trump Jr. has come out and said, you know, my dad, when he went down that escalator, said, now we find out who our friends are. And that's really exactly right. You find out who's going to call you and say, did you say this? You find out who's going to come out and say something about you behind your back. And that was pretty shocking. But I think that, you know, going around the state, the thing that was the most surprising to me, that was nothing to do with me at all, going around the state, if you go to other states, you see things thriving. I mean, we've gone to Dallas, we've gone to Nashville and seen folks down down in Nashville. And those cities are just booming. They have cars everywhere. People are driving around. All the restaurants are open. I think people don't realize in Michigan, we lost full communities. So as I was campaigning, I had people really literally falling into my arms and crying and saying, bring back our communities. We used to have a whole row of restaurants down the street. And out of the 6 restaurants that were here, there's one left. Our community. And that was really it. The sense of community totally lost. And so that was the most surprising thing to me as I started leaving the state to travel to some other cities and talk to folks about investing in Michigan. I saw, wow, the rest of the country has really bounced back and Michigan really hasn't. But the overwhelming joy of people too, the resilience of the human spirit, going out and talking to these people, and even through tears, they're just holding my hands and saying, we're going to pray for you. We want to see this happen. And it was such an amazing experience for people who are concerned about running for office, because it's brutal and you get attacked in the media, and the media is not your friend, especially if you are on the right side of the aisle. The media is not your friend. I have to tell you, it is the most rewarding thing you can do, to go out and talk to people and give them hope. That was just amazing. And I really encourage other people to go out and attempt to serve if you can.
Yeah, well, on the media side, as you'll be seeing more and more going forward, Tudor, for every 50 people on Twitter who tell you that, you know, meaning me in this case, you know, tell me that I'm horrible, dumb, ugly, and should, you know, go jump off a bridge, there'll be one person who comes up to me in an airport or while I'm in line at the grocery store who's like, I love your show. And all I ever remember is that person. We do it for that person, right? The other lunatics with their blue hair and their cat food, you know, they're sad. They're sad.
And those are not real people. And that's what I try to explain to people, that the Twitterverse is not the average person. The average person isn't on Twitter. They're not looking at what you're doing on Twitter. Twitter may set a media narrative, but the people are totally different. Tonight I was at my daughter's basketball game. I'm just watching the basketball game, and this woman kind of comes down the bleachers and sits next to me. And she said, I just want to tell you that we watched your entire race and we were so proud to be supporting you. And it really is so humbling, because you feel like, wow, I didn't even know that these people were out there, that they felt that way about me. And what can I do to keep that promise in other ways? And that's something that's been important to me in this. if I can't be serving them in that way, then I believe that God put me on this journey for some reason, that there's still a path to helping folks and making sure that we bring those communities back, whatever way I can do that. And so that's why I'm still in the game and I'm still focused on serving people however I can.
Did your daughter's team win, by the way?
No, it was terrible.
Oh, they got blown out? Oh, man, yeah. That could be a rough one. What was it? I mean, was the other team, just usually at that level? I coached high school soccer at one point. And if you have one or two players who are going to go, you can always tell too. One or two players on a team that are going to go college, especially if they're going to go play D1. That's the team that wins. Usually there's one or two standouts at that level. It wasn't happening.
No. Well, it's sixth grade, though. So sixth grade, everybody is still kind of, learning their own body, too. So, you go in and you never know. But the funny thing is, so my sixth grader plays basketball, and then my fourth graders play, they're twins, and they play basketball. And we are truly the shortest people here. So we live in an area of Michigan that is very Dutch, and Dutch people are all extraordinarily tall. Like, we walked into school the first day and people were like, oh, look at those tiny little children. But they were actually in the class with the other kids. They just thought that they were tiny little children. So no one expects my one daughter, she's the smallest, one of my twins, to be anything on the basketball court. And she is like so awesome. She goes out there and she made four baskets on Saturday. And she's just like this little ringer. No one expects it, which is kind of cool to watch when they're
there
that little.
This guy was amazing. Did you watch? Clay makes fun of me and says that I don't like sports. That's actually as I've gotten older. I don't really watch much professional sports. I do like playing sports and certainly hope to, coach my own kids one day. But way back in the day, I did watch NBA. Do you remember there was a guy, Muggsy Bogues, who was in the NBA? I think he was 5'5". There was a player in the NBA. He's a famous player. And then there was a guy named Spud Webb. This is back in the early 90s. And Spud Webb actually won the slam dunk contest, and he was 5'9". So I'm just saying, tell your girls.
There's a chance she will defy genetics and still be able to play basketball. But she's real. I mean, I never, it's funny because as a parent, there are things that your kids do and you never thought that could be possible. You're like, that's not part of us. It didn't come from me. It didn't come from my husband. So then they do something and it totally blows your mind. My oldest daughter is extraordinarily shy. And she went to school and she went to this school's new three. When COVID hit, we moved them to this school. And she tried out for the play, never done anything like this before. And the girl at the front desk said to me, well, Larkin's amazing. She's going to Hollywood. And I will confess that as a mom, I thought, she must have the wrong child because Larkin is shy. That's not her. And then she comes out on stage at the play and she's singing and she's like amazing. And I turn to my husband and I'm like, did you know she could sing? It's like, how do we not know this about our own kid? But I think that's the coolest part about parenting. Sometimes your child does something, you're like, where does that come from? But it's amazing. And there are things that are not amazing that they do too.
I've heard stories about that. I've got to ask you a few questions here. I got to ask you for some advice in a second, because Tudor, I'm getting married in just a matter of days. So I want the woman. Thank you. Yeah. I want the woman's perspective on how to make everything go as smoothly as possible for me for the next 40 years or so. So we'll get to that in just a second. Yeah, I'm sure you've got some thoughts. Heads up, if you're a T-Mobile subscriber, they're investigating a data breach that exposed the sensitive personal information of 37 million customers. Right after the new year, cyber hackers grab data without notice. It might include customer names, email, billing addresses, and phone numbers. If exploited, cyber criminals can use this information to commit online identity theft. If your own info is involved, how will you know? This is why you need LifeLock. LifeLock's online identity theft protection includes monitoring the web 24/7 for irregular activities and new account openings. Look, I've had LifeLock for years. If you don't have it online, you need to have it because they steal your information. They take out credit cards, loans, your name. It's a mess. It can mess up your credit. That's happened to me before. It's why I have LifeLock now to catch my back. You need it too. It's important to understand how cybercrime and identity theft are affecting our lives. And remember, if you do become a victim of identity theft, a LifeLock restoration specialist based here in the U.S. will help work with you to fix it. No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but it's easy to at least take the first step in protecting yourself with LifeLock. I've been using them for years. Remember, all you have to do is save up to 20. You can actually save 25% off your first year with promo code BUCK when you go to LifeLock.com. That's LifeLock.com. Use promo code Buck for 25% off or call 1-800-LIFELOCK. That's 1-800-LIFELOCK. And all right, Tudor. Now, this is the part of the podcast that everyone's going to have to take notes on. So you how many kids? You have three? You have three kids?
Four.
Four kids. Okay. So you are a happily married wife and mom with four kids. How do I follow in the footsteps here? I mean, obviously, I can't personally have the four kids, but I'd like to have two or three getting married. How do I have happy wife, happy life?
You know, I mean, if I had the answer to that, then I would not be podcasting. I would just be laying back in my private jet going wherever I wanted, right? Because everybody wants to know what the answer is. We are complicated people. Women, we're complicated. And it's very special.
That I know.
Okay?
Yeah.
Yes. So, and we like to make sure it's specialized to each one of us so that you are always confused. That's the goal.
Wow. It's working right now. I'm confused right now. I want an advice, and I feel like I know even less than I did 2 minutes ago.
But no, that's perfect. I think so you know that they say there's a love language, and I don't know if I really haven't read that book, but I will tell you that for me, if my husband empties the dishwasher or does the laundry, I am like, oh, that is so amazing. And I think that, well, at one point on the campaign trail, someone said to me, so what are your hobbies? And I thought, the only thing coming to mind right now is laundry, because when you have four kids, it's all you do. So when those chores are picked up by him, it's just such a relief and it makes me feel so happy inside. But I think everybody's different. So, you know, what my love language is obviously different than how someone else feels like they're cared for and taken care of. But that, I think, is the most important thing really in a relationship, is communicating what makes you feel like I'm there for you, that I'm a partner. And that's where I think we so oftentimes split in cases where we feel like we're doing it alone. We're doing life alone. And it might not be that you're doing life alone, but it might just be that you don't know what the other person needs to feel like they have a partner, a teammate alongside them. And when you have four kids, we're at the point where my twins are 9, and then I have 11 and 13. And it is a battle. You know, I kept thinking once they can tie their shoes, life will be so much easier. And then you have these moments where you think, well, once they can read, life will be so much easier. And it really is just a different level of hard. That's why that partnership with your spouse is so key. That partnership where you just feel like I'm safe with this person, because life is hard. And I think people expect life to be so easy. You know, I look at some of the things that we fight about in campaigns and I think life is not easy. You know, when my twins were 2, I had 2, 4, and 6 when I was diagnosed with cancer. And that was one of those moments where I thought, gosh, if this goes south, the twins probably won't remember me. My middle daughter won't likely remember much. And my 6-year-old will have very faint memories of me. And if you don't have that person, that support next to you saying, we're going to power through this, it's really hard. I mean, I just think it's a matter of finding where you prop up the person when they are falling over and making sure you're doing that.
What, may I ask, what kind of cancer were you battling at the time?
I had breast cancer. So that was really a shocking moment. It was interesting because, I mean, maybe this is too much information, but you all know this now. So when I went in, I was nursing at the time, and I would have never thought that this is what cancer felt like. I went into the doctor, and the physician's assistant was like, how long have you had this lump here? And I didn't think anything of it. So she sent me for a mammogram and an ultrasound. And I went in for the mammogram, and the girl said, you know what? The mammogram is totally clean. There's nothing there. They did send you for an ultrasound, so we'll do one just to be safe, but you're going to be fine. And I went in for the ultrasound, and you know, you go in and they're like, how many children do you have? Oh, 4. What are their names? And then they do the ultrasound, and their faces all changed. And it's like, how many children did you say you have? And I remember thinking,
wow.
this is not a good reaction. They said, would you mind staying for a biopsy? And so I stayed for the biopsy, and then it was like a miscommunication between the biopsy doctor and my doctor. My doctor thought that I knew, so that she called me into her office a few days later, and I walked in and she just immediately started handing me cancer brochures. And I said, do I have cancer? And she said, I thought they already told you. So then was the journey of what's next. And it's funny because when you end up with a diagnosis like this, everyone around you wants you immediately to go straight to the doctor and get it fixed, get it fixed. And I was sort of one of those people that wanted to talk to a few different doctors to find out. And I recommend that. I think it's so often as people, we think whatever the first doctor says, we have to listen. The doctor is the person of authority. We just have to go with that person. And the first doctor I talked to was just not the person. I ended up going to Johns Hopkins, and this is how cool this story is. After my surgery, 3 years after my surgery, my breast surgeon called me and he said, and you think about this, after all of these other people have gone in, because if you're in Johns Hopkins Cancer Center, you have somebody coming in every 5 minutes with breast cancer. But 3 years later, the surgeon called me and he said, I have a young woman, she's 35, she has the same cancer you have and she's really scared. Would you call her and talk her through it? How amazing is that?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's so important. Whenever someone has a really serious health issue, that there's that first thing, the first step is the feeling of alone. And, you know, when you're dealing with the health system, and I've had to deal with this with family members and who have had to go through, you realize one of the things that I think you have to fight along the way is the recognition that it feels sometimes like nobody cares about what you're going through but you. You know, when you're making your way through the hospital corridors, waiting in the waiting rooms and waiting for the meetings and the scans. And, you know, my grandmother had cancer, and she actually had multiple cancers at the same time. And being able to talk to somebody who's gone through it and come out on the other side, as you have in particular, as, you know, healthy and you know, prosperous as you've been, I think that would be a very powerful. I didn't know, by the way, that you would been through that you were a cancer survivor. So I'm glad that you got great care at Johns Hopkins University. So you're a mom. You have fought lots of battles already, come out of it successfully. What are you particularly energized about these days? What do you see? And you're like, this is the issue. This is the thing. I'm trying to transition to some. I do a lot of work on the border, and I think that immigration is a fascinating and really important, illegal immigration specifically. What for you right now is the thing that you're the most, we need to fix this in this country?
Well, it's funny that you bring up immigration, because I probably have a slightly different view on it than maybe other people, but maybe not. Maybe other people just haven't really talked about it this way. But as I told you, it's difficult to start a steel foundry in the United States because that's not the skill set that we have anymore. But my dad recently helped someone start a new foundry up in Indiana, and he wanted to bring in folks from the Czech Republic and Ukraine that were specialists in their field. But according to these immigration documents, to be considered a specialist in your field, you had to have a degree in that field. Well, we need laborers, and these are people that are truly specialists in pouring molten metal. And that may seem like you can just pour it any which way, but it really is something that you have to be skilled to know. And so when you talk about immigration, I think about immigration reform. Michigan is dying for workers right now. We need workers in hotels. We need workers in restaurants. We need workers in factories. These are, in many cases, skilled laborers that want to come into this country that can't. So when we keep hearing from everybody, oh, there's just people that want to come in, there's people that want to come in, you cannot tell me that the United States of America, with this, the intelligent people that we have and the data that we have and the technology that we have, that we would not be able to create an immigration system that would be able to match people to the open positions that we have and say, if you are able to do this job and you want to stay in this job for however long, you can earn your green card, or you can earn your citizenship over time by filling a position that we simply cannot fill. And this is the time. I mean, you're hearing about the lack of workers, right? Aren't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, one thing that I'm hearing a lot, we actually just talked to Chef Andrew Gruhl, who runs a restaurant out in Los Angeles about this. And I think it's really important that we can't get people to show up to work because we keep thinking you pay them more than what they can get from the system and they'll show up, right? So it's 20. If minimum wage in Los Angeles is $15, which I think it is, it's something like that. But if somebody can make the equivalent of $10 or $12 an hour staying home with welfare and various benefits that they have, unemployment for however long they can get it, things like that. You have to pay them a lot more than a little more than that to make them show up to a job and actually give you 8 hours of their day. And that's where he says there's a gulf right now. There are a lot of people that are in kind of the gray economy, side hustles, get money from the state, have their hands in different things. And when you say, OK, well, I'm paying a good wage, they say, yeah, but I have to show up to get that wage. This other stuff, I do whatever I want, which I mean, it was eye opening to hear it from somebody who's, you know, trying to run a business and keep a balance sheet healthy.
But that's what we keep saying in Michigan. Where did everyone go? And there are so many, as you put it, side hustles right now. And even young people, even my own kids talk about, well, if I were to grow up and work on Instagram or work on, and I keep saying, those are not really real jobs. I mean, for some people, it really is a real job.
She's but, on a podcast but, and she's like, it's not a real job. No, I like that. That's fine. That's good. It's okay. But, I mean, it's not. That, I mean, Clay and I joke around about this all the time. We're like, how could we get paid to do this? It's crazy, but go ahead.
And it's not that I would say to my kids, you know, only a few people actually get to be football stars, but it is kind of like that. You know, this is this is a really hard career to make money in. It is not like you're going to go to a restaurant and get hired and be able to work right away. But there are so many young people that believe, well, so-and-so can just travel around the country and take pictures and become very wealthy. And so is that causing a lack of work ethic? Is it just because it's easy to make a few dollars here and then take a few days off? We do seem to have a work ethic problem in the United States. And I don't know that we've really identified where it's coming from. In Michigan, I've had people come up with all kinds of theories. Oh, the marijuana industry, it pays under the table. Maybe they all went there, but how could all of these people go? Now, Michigan's unique. We have people leaving the state as well, so we're losing population. That always hurts. But where are all the workers? And yet you have all these people that would love to come into the country and fill those jobs and not necessarily have a minimum wage that puts the restaurant out of business. We have some interesting things going on in Michigan where you might get rid of tipping, have all servers make a certain minimum wage. Some servers don't like that because if they get tipped at a restaurant, they can make way more than minimum wage. So it's a tough situation because people don't seem to want, you're right, they don't want to work the full day. You have made people so jealous of you, they just want your job, Buck.
Well, see, they have to recall, though, that, for example, there was a time when I had to show up to the NYPD and clock in to the minute. And if I was 1 minute late, I had to literally 1 minute late for my tour. I would have to fill out forms explaining why I was late. I would have to add time onto the back. You know, so when you've done those kinds of jobs where they want, I mean, same thing, the CIA. I mean, it's the CIA. They know where you are, right? So when I would come in, you're expected to be there the certain hours you're there. And they're also, people talk about overtime and stuff, but we would just, you would work way more hours than what was expected. I mean, we were in a war office, effectively, the Iraq office. And so there wasn't a lot of like, oh, it's 5 o'clock, time to go. You know, if there was work to be done, people just stayed and did it. But yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, coming into media, I joke about this with people all the time in the business. I'm like, it is a gift. I feel like everybody who gets to make content and inform people for a living is incredibly lucky. And if you've done other jobs as I have before this, you know, I was doing Intel work for about 7 years. Then when you get to do this, you say to yourself, well, this is really a special thing. I mean, I could be sitting here. People don't even know. I could be sitting here in my pajamas right now doing this podcast. They don't even know. That would not have flown in the Iraq office. Let me tell you that. It was jacket and tie every day there. So I think if I were the king of New York, that I could fix New York City pretty quickly because I know the city super well and I understand the deficiencies. I firmly believe that. Like if New York would just bring me in and let me be more than the mayor, I'd have to be kind of the dictator of New York. Like I couldn't have like the city council chirping in my ear about some nonsense. If they just empowered me, I could fix it. Detroit used to be one of the greatest cities in America. Now Detroit, unfortunately, I mean, I grew up, I watched the RoboCop movies, you know, Beverly Hills Cop. I mean, Detroit has a reputation as a city. And it is not a particularly pleasant one for the last 20, 30 years or so. Could it be fixed? Do you think you could bring Detroit back?
Well, I will tell you, one of the, you asked earlier, what's some of the most shocking stuff you discovered on the campaign trail? There is a significant amount of corruption in the state of Michigan. So that is part of the big problem in Detroit. But of course, yes, it can be fixed. It can be brought back. Detroit should be, I mean, Detroit really should overtake Chicago and be the big city of the Midwest because it's beautiful. We have an incredible landscape. You can just go up, just go north of Detroit. You'd be right on an island. You can be vacationing. You can go up to Mackinac. You can vacation. You can come over to my side of the state and be at the beach. Michigan is an absolutely stunning state. You can go skiing. You can go snow skiing in the winter. You can go water skiing in the summer. And you have this beautiful city right on the edge of the state. And you can go back and forth to Canada. You could go over there and gamble if you want. You can come right back. You can do all kinds of fun things from the state of Michigan and from the city of Detroit. But we have, and it has built back quite a bit. Detroit is much better than what you think of Detroit from the past. The reputation of Detroit has kind of stuck with it. But if you go into Detroit now, there's so many communities that have been built up, really beautiful communities. And it does have a ways to go, but it is certainly not from the standpoint of you see the murders in Chicago and St. Louis all the time. And Detroit is very dangerous, but we don't have that kind of level of crime. So I do believe that that's been worked on. There's the opportunity to increase community policing to make sure that we are building back that city and get investors. But to get investors into Detroit, you really have to make Michigan as a state more appealing. And that's one of the things that we talked about quite a bit on the campaign trails. How do we make Michigan more appealing to businesses? I think in the last 10 years, Dallas has increased by 200 headquarters. The state of Michigan doesn't have that. So if we can make the state of Michigan look better and build the roads that we need for new businesses, make sure that we get our energy costs down, bring more businesses here, then we can build up Detroit. We can have investors come and build up Detroit. But really, Detroit gets a bad rap. It has cleaned it up quite a bit. There has been a lot of good work in policing done there to bring the city back and make it safer. Needs to be more done in the city of Detroit, but I would love to see it be the shining star in the Midwest.
Yeah, I do think at one point it was the highest back in the 50s, the era of Ford, obviously, it was the highest per capita concentration of millionaires of any city in the United States, which I think is a interesting statistic. And also there's all these, you've probably seen it, these urban tours or urban kind of photography landscape things where they'll go and they'll show these beautiful old buildings in Detroit that have been abandoned. You know, these things right. that were built that looked like cathedrals practically. I mean, they're amazing structures have just been, left to grow with vines and trash and everything. So clearly there's a great history. I have heard the downtown has gotten a lot better. I've never been to Detroit, so maybe this is an opportunity for me to put it on the list.
There you go. Come spend some money in the state of Michigan. But I will say that if we're being really honest about Michigan, you brought up Ford. What a perfect time to talk about the fact that the automotive industry is leaving the state of Michigan. And Gretchen Whitmer will go out every day and tell you all of the auto jobs that she's brought back. We lost 32,000 auto jobs. I think 34,000, 82,000 jobs total in the state of Michigan while she was governor. But our auto jobs have really, really declined over the past 4 years. And the auto companies, she'll tell you that the auto companies are coming here, that we're getting these battery plants, but you're seeing the battery plants go into Ohio, go into Tennessee, go into North Carolina. And where the battery plants are, you will see the assembly plants because that battery is the same size as the vehicle. So right now, I had a donor say to me, well, we didn't want to support you in the race because we weren't sure what would happen. So we cut a deal with Whitmer and she said that she would do all these things if we donated to her. And then can you believe one of the first things they decided to do was go after Right to Work in the state of Michigan?
Just yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't believe it.
How did you not?
I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty. We're the Armstrong and Getty Show.
We cover the stories the mainstream media ignores.
Stories that are important to your life and important to the world.
The election, of course.
The many trials of Donald Trump.
Couple of wars.
Gender-bending madness.
Why are kids looking at so much social media?
And we bring you the stories the mainstream media is on,
but we do it without the left-wing media spin.
Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Open your free iHeart app and search the Armstrong and Getty Show to start listening.
I mean, I know that you're in the commentary realm now. You're not an active race. Is Gretchen Whitmer a bad person? Because what she did during the pandemic makes me think she's a bad person. I'm just going to ask you.
I will just say that my interactions with her were always very pleasant. So
you are such a nice person. I have to say, you're a very nice lady. I'm impressed. I haven't even met her and I want to trash her. I'm like, I cannot believe what you did. Keep going. I'm sorry.
Well, I she was always very nice to me. I don't like her policies. I mean, and I will never like her policies because her policies are very progressive. She is a very far leftist. So this is not somebody who is, I mean, she's talking about shutting down our pipeline. And that's something that nobody really addresses. A few people address, but this is something that she's been pushing for 4 years, shutting down our pipeline in the state of Michigan. She's very progressive with hunting. They came out with this new hunting rule where if you shoot a deer, you have to report it on this website now within 40 or 72 hours. And our hunters are like, you know, a lot of times we're out, you know, a week where we don't have any service and we can't do this. Oh, it doesn't matter if you get a misdemeanor.
Why do you have to report shooting a deer? I don't know. What's the point of that?
The Department of Natural Resources has to know if every time there is a deer that is taken out of the herd and they keep track of exactly how many deer are shot every year, which I understand, but it's the amount of time that you have to have it done and you have to do it online. This is something that is not easy for our hunters, but then they're coming out with these rules. Agencies that are not legislators are coming out with rules that end up with misdemeanors if you don't do them. And guess what? If you get a misdemeanor, then you lose your CPL. So you can have your guns taken away. You can have your rights taken away because someone who's not a lawmaker made a law that results in you getting a misdemeanor that results in no CPL.
Are you a hunter, by the way? Do you hunt?
I am not a hunter, but I spent a lot of time. So I spent a lot of time with hunters while I was campaigning and learning. You know, I'm one of those people that I feel like I have to do it so I can totally understand it. So one day they said, do you want to go bear hunting? And I'm like, of course. But inside I thought, I'm going to tell you right now,
Tudor, just you, me, and the many, many people who will hear this. So this is like we're in the friend zone here, the trust tree. I think bears are so cute. I could never shoot a bear.
This is my fear. I'm like, I'm going to be really strong. I'm going to watch this happen. And I worried about it for 2 weeks beforehand. And I'm like, what's it like? You know, in my mind, we are out all day going through the woods, you know, in all camo and trying to find these deer. And we get there and like, no. You ride in a car, you look for the tracks, and then you chase this deer down. But fortunately, we were a week before you could actually shoot the deer. So this was just like practice deer or bear chasing. Bear chasing, yes. So we couldn't shoot any bears while we were out there, but we could track them down and chase them. And then they send these dogs. The dogs are really, they chase, yeah. So yeah. It was a rough...
I just want to be friends with the bear and let them get a picnic basket.
I don't think they want to be friends with you though, so you should be careful.
That is probably true, actually. They're they look cute from afar. I remember I saw grizzlies up in Alaska, and from far away, you're like, they're majestic and beautiful. And then it got within about 50 yards of us, and I was like, we all have 50 cal handguns, right? Like, you know, you start to your whole sensibility goes from these things are amazing. I feel like I'm watching Wild Kingdom and Richard Attenborough's narrating to we're not gonna like get eaten, right? You know, it shifts very quickly when they get much.
The grizzlies are there. Well, they are. Yeah, we have black bears here. They're a little bit more cuddly,
yeah,
but I don't
like giant trash pandas. They're like overgrown raccoons. most black bears aren't really that big. Before we close, actually, I have kind of a serious question, a political analysis question. I want to ask you more about hunting and, well, actually, a quick one. What is the most underrated place in Michigan in your mind? Underrated.
Ooh, the most
You know, whether it's a city underrated. Or a place to go, like what's the place that, you know, you would say, you know, for, like, I don't know. If I were talking about New York, which I know super well, I would say underrated, although everyone knows everything in New York, but the North Shore of, rather the North Fork of Long Island is really amazing. And you get a lot of the advantage of the very famous Hamptons beaches without the price and the craziness, for example. Right. So.
Well, we spent a lot of time in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and I think that if you haven't been there, I mean, it is truly God's country. It is the summertime. It is so beautiful. We went in the summer. We went in February. February, you have to be a hardcore to go in February because I thought, I live on the west side of Michigan where we get lake effect snow. So in my mind, I'm thinking, I've seen a whiteout. I know how bad snow is. No. It was nothing compared to a whiteout. I mean, I couldn't even see my fingers in front of my face. This was so snowy, but we got to see the dog sled race. If you have never done that, that's what I think is underrated. You've got to go stand out in the cold with your hot cocoa and watch these people, these mushers, get on their sleds and take off and just know that they're going to be outside in this frigid cold night after night, snuggled up with their dogs. And it is pretty majestic to see that happen.
I mean, this might tell you, I'm the guy at the ski lodge who is all about room service and like the hot tub situation. I'm like, everyone, I'm going to go to the spa.
You know, winter's not for everyone.
You know? Yeah. I have no shame. I'm like this. I'm taking a spa day while everyone else is snowshoeing or mushing or whatever. One last thing for you. Just how do we get a Republican to win? This was the serious question that I was going to ask you. How do we get a Republican to win in Michigan in 2024? Because that's obviously really important.
So this is the major question in the state of Michigan, because you know that Michigan, not only did we lose the governor's seat, but we lost the state and the state house and state senate. So we'd had a majority for 40 years, lost everything. So for Michigan, I think it's really important to look to Florida. And I say that because I think so many people say to me regularly, oh, Ron DeSantis has been able to do great things in Florida, but Ron DeSantis has only been able to do great things in Florida because so much of the procedure on the ground was set up in the past for him. And I mean that by Rick Scott, by Jeb Bush, the ground game that we've talked about so much, about mail-in ballots. You know, Florida was never complaining about this. They knew that a lot of their population is using mail-in ballots. So they had that ground game of chasing ballots. We as Republicans have a habit of chasing voters. We have rallies. We talk to people. We want to get people together. And we think we've got all these voters. But for Democrats, this is a machine. We want, if you're a Democrat, we want ballots in our bag. We know we have them. They're packed away. Those votes are, we already have them. We've already counted them. So that's what we have to change our mindset as Republicans and say, we've got to play on the same level. We have got to make sure that we're doing that we are identifying new voters. We find out who they are. And Florida has done this. Florida has registered more Republicans every single year. A ground game like you would not believe. Going out using data, checking to see how many people are in this neighborhood, how many are Republicans. The rest who aren't registered are probably Republicans. We'll go do that. And they go and they register them. Then they hunt the mail-in ballots. They've got this down. So I'm saying for all states, if you're looking at all states that are saying, wow, how are we going to get back in the game as Republicans and win? Let's take a look at what the successful states have done, what their motto or what their method has been to get those ballots and bring that to our other purple states and turn them red. But it's hard. It's work. It's got to be a lot of raising money. It's got to be a lot of people on the ground. This is a business. This is not just a feeling. It's got to be a business mindset of we have a job to do and we've got to get it done.
Tudor, thanks so much for being with us here today on the Buck Sexton Show. Where can everyone go to follow your work, your projects ahead, help you save Michigan, make Michigan great again, all of it?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Tudor Dixon, on Facebook at Tudor Dixon, and the TudorDixon.com website is under construction. We will be unveiling something new soon, so stay tuned for that and check back in.
Tudor Dixon, thanks so much for being with us. Good to see you.
Thank you so much.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.